RA Exchange. Welcome to Resident Advisors Exchange. I'm your host and the Exchange's senior producer, Chloe Lula. This week's Exchange was recorded live at Deckmantle, where I had the opportunity to sit down with Gabrielle Quartang, a rising talent living in Berlin, but hailing from New York. Quartang's name has begun gracing stages at major festivals and clubs around the world, where she delivers a unique brand of dynamic house-heavy sets that incorporate elements of funk, soul, acid, techno, and everything in between. In our interview, we talked about Quartang's upbringing in a Ghanaian household in the Bronx, and how that unique environment and the neighborhood itself molded her taste in music. The community she grew up in was culturally diverse, filled with the sounds of reggaeton, bachata, merengue, and freestyle from Puerto Rico, the Dominican Republic, and beyond.
Yeah, I was just surrounded by all walks of life, and it wasn't until later realizing how much I took that for granted, you know, being in spaces where there were just so many different types of people, but we all shared this neighborhood.
As both of her parents moved from West Africa, she was introduced to a diet of high life music and jazz from a young age. As she grew up and began exploring New York's record stores, her taste began to expand. Fast forward to university, and Quartang became deeply involved in her school radio station, which she describes as a turning point and a revelation.
It was the first time that I was sharing music with people outside of my family and friends. I often subjected people in my life to, like, yeah, having to listen to whatever I discovered and whatnot. But at this point, you know, I had a wider audience.
She spoke to me about the abiding power that radio has had in her life. She continues to be involved with stations like Refuge Worldwide and The Lot Radio. She also talked about what it's like to be a female minority in the music industry, the experience of having her career take off at such rapid speed upon relocating to Europe, and the importance of summoning optimism in what continues to be such an energetically heavy world. Thank you so much for tuning in. Without further ado, here is Gabrielle Quartang. Welcome to the final RA Exchange of the day. My name is Chloe Lula. I am the host and the senior producer of The Exchange. And today I am joined by Gabrielle Quartang.
Thank you for having me.
Yes. You are a self-described DJ, radio host, and curator. How do all these facets of your identity interact? And is there one that supersedes the other?
I'd say that the common thread between DJing, being on the radio, and curating is selecting music. You know, with DJing, I'm performing in front of crowds of however many people, whereas radio, oftentimes in a studio, like alone. So it's a bit more isolating, but still, you know, knowing that you're sharing your music, it's being like received through the sonic waves. And with curating, you know, working with spaces, keeping it in mind that whether it's creating a playlist for a space, knowing that it's going to be inhabited by people that are going to consume said music, for instance.
You grew up in New York, which is a very culturally diverse and rich environment. I think anyone who's been there can kind of attest to that. It's just very dynamic in a way that I think some European capitals aren't always. Where did you grow up in New York? How do you feel that it shaped you?
I grew up in the Bronx. Uptown. I mean, contrary to popular belief, I know, like, you know, the Bronx is often stereotyped as being a really dangerous borough and whatnot, but I lived quite a sheltered life in a very residential area near one of the largest parks in the Bronx, Cortona Park. And yeah, it was just a really rich and vibrant neighborhood filled with people of different backgrounds, you know, generational African-Americans to first-generational migrant families from Latin America, Africa, the Caribbean, Asia as well. So yeah, I was just surrounded by all walks of life. And it wasn't until later realizing how much I took that for granted, you know, being in spaces where there were just so many different types of people, but we all shared this neighborhood.
Yeah. You know, there are a lot of families like from Puerto Rico, the Dominican Republic, and they bring their musical traditions with them. And I believe you're listening to a lot of reggaeton and merengue and freestyle. And that soundtracked a lot of your childhood, I guess.
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah. And both of your parents moved to the Bronx from Ghana.
My mom did. Actually, Brooklyn. I was born in Brooklyn by Prospect Park and lived there for a couple of years. And then we moved to the Bronx.
Okay.
And then I grew up there. But my dad actually, when he was 21, moved to Amsterdam from Ghana, funnily enough. And he lived here for about 7 years in the 70s. And then found his way to Texas and then Brooklyn.
Okay.
And then my mom was in Brooklyn from Ghana and then the Bronx. But
okay.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, West Africa is known for high life music, especially. How would you describe it to someone who doesn't know what high life is?
High life is a genre originated in like the late 19th century, but grew really popular in the 50s. It's really like positive, uplifting genre that involves like traditional like Ghanaian rhythms, like from like percussion to brass, guitar, and also incorporates like, yeah, fusions of jazz. Yeah, and there are a lot of like just melodies and beautiful vocals. And I just think about how warm that genre is. And I'll never forget being at a listening bar, like, I don't know, circa 2017, 2018, when there was this resurgence of like old school West African music being really popular amongst vinyl diggers. And I was at a listening bar and hearing Ebel Taylor come on, music I'd grown up on in this like really hipster bar in Williamsburg. And it's really interesting seeing how far like a genre has come along from my living room to like a hipster bar in Williamsburg.
So, I mean, both of your parents, from my understanding, were pretty into music. You listened to a lot of high life growing up, and not to mention a lot of these other genres that were just like in the neighborhood. Can you talk about what your listening diet was like?
Yeah. So you've already mentioned some genres I grew up on just through osmosis growing up in the Bronx, you know, which was reggaeton, merengue, bachata, to dancehall, and then hip hop, which of course, you know, I was in New York. And yeah, but then I just remember being in school, like in high school, and, you know, partying, like beginning to like go to parties. And it was from dancehall parties, you know, deep in Brooklyn to reggaeton parties in Washington Heights. And then at some point, discovering rave culture and warehouse, like, you know, abandoned warehouses in Williamsburg before it became gentrified. And there was this fusion of like this subculture of what was happening. This is like the MySpace era. So I don't know, circa 2007, 8, 9. A lot of young artists from New York, like Theophilus London, Princess Nokia, Jungle Pussy, Ninja Sonic, kind of doing this hybrid of like dance music with hip hop and R&B. And yeah, these are genres that really spoke to me during this time.
So you went to school and you became really active in radio. And it seems like that was quite a turning point and a revolution for you. Can you talk a little bit about that and why it was that radio resonated so much?
Yeah, like my relationship with radio. Yeah, I began in university at Skidmore College, which is in upstate New York. Yeah, I just remember seeing an advert that they were looking for a new radio host. I think this was my sophomore year. Yeah, to, you know, send in a submission with a premise and was accepted. And yeah, from then on, I had a radio show sophomore year and my senior year because I studied abroad my junior year. And
where did you study?
No, I was in Paris first, then London.
Okay.
So I was gone for an entire year.
Okay.
Yeah, returning to radio, it was the first time that I was sharing music with people outside of my family and friends. Mm-hmm. I often subjected people in my life to like, yeah, having to listen to whatever I discovered and whatnot, whether it's making mixtapes and CDs. But at this point, you know, I had a wider audience. Yeah, I really enjoyed being able to share music that way.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you had a morning show, is that right?
Yes, I had a morning show. My sophomore year, it was at 3 a.m. from 3 to 5, and I had a 9 a.m. class. So I sadly had to give
very
that up because after a few, like, sleeping through some courses, I had to give that up, sadly. But then the following semester, I got an 8 a.m., which was a lot more manageable.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because I think I read that what your professors would listen to your show when they were driving into campus. Okay, cool.
Exactly. So then I had like an 8 to 10 a.m. show that was a lot more manageable. And I also shared that with a friend. The first show I had that alone. I hosted that alone. But yeah, it was cool. You know, I was working on my radio voice and whatnot, trying to figure out how that worked.
What is your radio voice?
I don't know. I'm still trying to figure that out. But I think it depends on the time, maybe. Yeah. But yeah.
And then after school, you went on to hold a residency at The Law at Radio. And you're now a resident at Refuge Worldwide Radio. What have each of these radio stations provided in terms of like your musical trajectory and just like your personal development?
Well, what I'd say about, you know, those two radio stations, like I actually had shows on both during their early on stages, like at The Lot in 2016. Yeah, when it first came about. Same with Refuge around the time when they were in Wessestrasse. And just watching them grow, not just be radio stations, but just like pillars within the musical community, both, you know, respective cities. And yeah, I find that, yeah, it's amazing. And yeah, you know, with The Lot having the video streaming element, you know, was really unique at the time. And yeah, and Refuge, it's just great. It's like really beautiful studio space. Yeah. And, you know, the natural wine doesn't hurt. So, yeah.
Is there music that you gravitate towards for radio play versus for playing in a club or at a festival? Or is it just an extension of your, like your DJ?
Yeah, I would say an extension in the sense where definitely, like, I think on radio, there is a bit more room for me to play around with different sounds that I'm not getting booked for, or like, perhaps it's just like not the right timing, you know, whether it's like my more trippier psychedelic or dubbier sounds, or even if I just want to like play some jazz or whatnot, but also using the opportunity to perhaps like test out tracks that I want to play in a club and just hearing it, you know, blasting in the studio space.
Yeah, yeah. So my understanding is that you spent some summers with family in the UK, and it was the first time you really understood that music culture in America and in Europe differ significantly. Can you talk a little bit more about that?
Yeah, when I think about the differences between like the US and like Europe, let's say, I mean, it wasn't until a lot later, I feel like, you know, moving here in the last couple of years and recognizing that, yeah, music has just been consumed significantly differently. For instance, you know, the drinking age already inhibits like, you know, the youth in the US being able to access spaces that, for instance, in Europe, you know, you're 18, you can easily just walk into any old club and see your favorite DJ. But, you know, if you're 17, 18 in the US, it's not so easy. And a lot of these artists aren't normally playing like, you know, underground spaces or raves that this American 17, 18 year old is going to. So I feel like, yeah, it, you know, kind of hinders that accessibility. And another difference I've always, like, I've spoken about extensively with friends is the festival culture. You know, I didn't go to my first festival, I think, until I was maybe 24 or something. When I think about, you know, like doing the whole thing, like camping and whatnot. You know, of course, we've had like, we have some festivals like Afropunk and whatnot back in New York, but it didn't have that like camping element, let's say, or like 5 days of just, you know, consuming music in this great big space of trees or something.
Yeah.
And I think like even, yeah, the huge difference in festival cultures between the US and Europe.
Yeah.
Sure.
I mean, you've now, so you've been living in Europe for about 5 years.
Well, 5 years at this point, but I first moved to London in 2009 when I was 18.
Okay.
So I've hopped in and out since 2009.
How would you characterize the key differences in attitudes towards music and music culture here? I mean, not just in terms of what people generally listen to, because I do think that's different as well, but also just how like electronic music culture and institutions are treated in Europe versus in the US.
I mean, I definitely think there's a lot more red tape in the US, sadly, but I think it also returns to like the lack of infrastructure. I find that from what I hear, you know, having friends that like, whether they own clubs or promoters, there's just a lot more funding, it seems, and like support from whether it's the local government or the government, and something that I think can be lacking in the US, especially nowadays. And, you know, it just makes it so much harder, at least from my understanding.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
How did moving to Berlin change your taste in music and the way you DJ?
I wouldn't say that Berlin has necessarily changed my taste, but I think it's just perhaps like boosted my confidence and tapping into other parts of myself musically. this is something I reflect on. And I think, you know, it's allowed me to tap into whether it's like my moodier side or like maybe like grittier side. And that's, you know, executed in a set where I'm playing it maybe a little bit harder or faster. I think, you know, when I moved to Berlin, it also allowed me to kind of move here as a blank canvas and just, yeah, really just refine myself as an artist. And I continue to do so.
Yeah. What was your relationship to DJing before you moved here? So I'm guessing, but did you move really just to like focus solely on DJing?
Yeah, actually. I had already been DJing for a couple of years in the US. I think I'd come to Europe like the purpose of DJing like in 2018, trying to like cut my teeth. And then I decided, I was like, maybe I should spend a summer in Berlin and see what's up. And I had a few festivals lined up in 2019. And yeah, I was just kind of testing the waters and yeah, applied for a visa and then still here.
Well, I want to talk about your approach to digging because you do play a lot of fresh contemporary music, but you also like to nod to the past. I mean, your influences from your family and also from New York, I mean, they come through in your sets and your selections. Your bio says that you weave stories for the dance floor that often look to the past and traverse diasporas, always focusing on possible futures. So I wanted to ask a little bit about what you mean by traversing diasporas and eras, and if that's something you consciously try to do when you're putting a set together, or if that's more just like a byproduct of your taste.
Yeah, I'd say it's more of a byproduct. Yeah, I don't think like there's like this conscious decision. It definitely feels a bit more subconscious and a bit more effortless because it's also like how I consume music. So I think like, yeah, when I'm thinking of a set, I'm not really thinking there has to be like five tracks from like the 80s in here. Mm-hmm. It just happens organically, or whether it's even a track that perhaps sampled from that or is, you know, so on and so forth. So, I mean, I approach DJing like, you know, storytelling, you know, telling a narrative. So for me, it's just all interwoven in that sense.
How do you keep music from the past feeling fresh?
I think I don't need to. I think the track will speak for itself.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah. It seems like you like to focus on work from artists who like to blend subgenres. And we did talk about this, like with going to the warehouse parties, that there was a lot of hybridization. Yeah. And you included this artist, IMVT, who I know mixes a lot of like Kuduro and then Latin infused bass and UKG. Like, are those the artists who you feel that you're really gravitating towards?
I wouldn't necessarily say just particularly, but yes, definitely. Like, for instance, IMVT, I love their sound. I mean, it's amazing seeing from one like where Latin Club is going and seeing how far it's, yeah, just like being elevated, I'd say, within the music industry, like the electronic sphere right now. And for me, I think it's just reminiscent perhaps of like my background when I think about just the fusions like of music, like that was just surrounding me. So when I hear these type of genres, yeah, I must subconsciously gravitate towards them.
Yeah.
In that sense.
It seems like there is more of an openness to like genre blending now than there was even a few years ago. Yeah. Why do you think that is?
I do think that there has been a lot more of an open-mindedness perhaps maybe since lockdown because we had something taken away from us. So when the industry reopened, I feel like there was this like thirst for just, you know, anything, honestly, because, you know, it's taken away for a couple of years. With that being said, I am finding this genre, like blends and hybridization, just being more accepted in that sense. And perhaps it's also just a sign of globalization, you know, we're all like, you know, merging and continuing to do so.
Yeah.
You know, as cultures.
You said that you like to focus on possible futures. What does that mean to you? Like, how do you evoke a possible future in a DJ set?
Perhaps it is like that globalization. I think, you know, for instance, even when I think of my own sets, it's always been quite difficult for me to just stay within just one lane of genre anyway. You know, I'll play like a really cunty ballroom track and then like segue into like a really moody, like psychedelic, I don't know, like acid-y track and then bring it back to something a bit more light and upbeat and whatnot. And I feel like, yeah, I think for me, that's, I guess, how I envision the future of music, just being able to like interweave like genres that on paper you think wouldn't even make sense together.
Totally. What do you look for when you search for music, or what makes a track speak to you?
Many elements, honestly, because just as much as, you know, the percussion in a track will just have me like shaking and baking and grooving. You know, I do love a really great melody. It just really depends.
Yeah.
But also makes sense, I guess, to me, just in my head. My head is just like things are just spinning and it just fits like a puzzle.
Okay. You've written about being a minority in the industry, but also just in general. And you wrote this really interesting article about your hair for Vogue magazine a few years ago. And the premise of it was talking about why you don't like the term dreadlocks, why you style your hair naturally. And I mean, without moving on to too much of a tangent, though I think it's related, can you talk about that piece and what motivated you to write it?
Yes, I wrote this, you could say, like non-fictional essay about hair discrimination. Yeah, using my story on my relationship with my natural hair journey and locks back in 2020. It was like in light of George Floyd's murder, and I'd just been feeling really hopeless and was just journaling a lot. And I remember writing particularly about hair discrimination. I think it just popped up to me one morning, and I showed it to one of my best friends who said that I should try to get this published. And then I just shopped it around, and then Vogue, they were interested, and they asked if I could expand and perhaps, like, you know, bring in like the sociopolitical and historical elements. So then I reached out to a hair historian. Yeah, stumbled on her book where she talked about, yeah, just the hair history, particularly like Black hair. And yeah, and she was intrigued, and we spoke on the phone for 2 hours. And yeah, I got so much more information just about just how Black hair has been perceived in the US, like dating back. I can't remember how far back her book had dated, but yeah, and just using that to tie that into my own experiences. And yeah.
No, it was really interesting. Yeah. I didn't know anything about that history. Wait, can you explain how the term dreadlocks started?
Yeah, I mean, from my understanding, I mean, some people, like, I've heard different stories, but this resonated with me was that it had been coined when there were British soldiers in Africa, and then they had seen the hair, this hairstyle on African people, and they called it dreadful. And then in turn, like, then it just like locks, meaning hair, and then dreadful, mm-hmm. and then adding dread to locks. So for me, it just always had this negative connotation. Yeah. And it's funny, my locksician, like, there are many people who have locks that we've had this conversation extensively about that. And just the power in words and not being able to ignore that.
Yeah. Yeah. Because you opened the essay by talking about how you always felt this pressure to, I guess, like to straighten it.
Straighten.
Yeah. Do you feel like how you choose to present yourself has affected the way you're treated in, I don't know, in the music industry, but also just in life?
Yes and no. I do find that, I mean, you know, this was a conscious decision, you know, to wear my hair. And I mean, sadly, like the fact that having to wear my hair a certain way is still deemed like a political decision, you know? Mm. But with that being said, you know, I celebrate it. And, you know, I'll even tie that into the fact that I chose to use my name as my stage name, you know, like, and also like elevating like my surname, you know, which is Ashanti from Ghana, and wanting that to still be a part of a conversation starter, which it is sometimes, you know, like speaking with promoters and they'll ask about my name. And yeah.
Yeah. Do you feel that the climate has changed for women and minorities working in the music industry since, I mean, I guess you're still relatively fresh, but you've still been, you know, you've been involved for a while now.
Yeah, I'd say so.
Yeah.
Of course, you know, still a long way to go and a lot of work to do, but it is incredibly refreshing to, you know, be working with more female promoters, for instance, or people of color in these positions of power in the industry, you know, whether it's from the promoter to like your artist care, having that be, you know, a person of color or a woman. Yeah, I do think that there have been changes compared to when I think about just like even just before lockdown, did feel absolutely a lot more homogenous during that time.
Yeah. You seem like a very positive person.
Thank you.
But also it comes across in your sets. And I'm wondering, is that like part of your personality DNA, or is that an attitude you've learned to cultivate over the years?
Well, I'd say a bit of both. Mainly in my DNA. I mean, I've definitely had my like moody adolescent periods for sure, where it was a bit harder to be as positive. But generally speaking, I'd say so. I also in the last years have like reconnected with my spirituality, which has helped, and rediscovering meditation and other spiritual practices. And yeah, it's just allowed me to, yeah, help me remain positive. I mean, it's not the most positive world we live in these days, but it's definitely helped.
Yeah, I think in some ways, yeah, choosing to be positive is, it is really kind of a choice. So you had spiritual practices that I guess you dropped for a little bit. What has like inspired you to pick them back up again?
Honestly, I can't even like pinpoint a particular moment, but as cliche as it sounds, it just felt like callings perhaps, you know, just feeling like I just really needed to reconnect with that part of myself. And it's also helped with, you know, like my stage fright and my nerves and boosting my own confidence, self-confidence. Yeah, I'd say like all those variables.
Yeah. You said in an interview that you're not interested in playing music that does not vibrate the higher chakras, especially the heart chakra. What kind of music vibrates higher chakras?
Well, I have to say like that was a few years ago. And actually my perspective on that has shifted because I do believe that all chakras, definitely there's a purpose for each, every single chakra that we have. And I think at the time I was looking at spirituality on this pedestal that like the lower chakras, which are a bit more connected to us on this physical plane, you know, was perhaps us like maybe not focusing on the wrong things in life, but is not the case. Like, it's just like how there are two sides of each coin. And when I tie that into music, for instance, I'd say, you know, when you're entering this state of euphoria, for instance, like that's more or less kind of entering like this more spiritual state. And I'd say like the higher chakras, you know, whether it's like third eye or crown or whatnot, but then the lower chakras, like the root, you know, like probably like this really like cunty, sexy track, you know, that would be a bit more in the root, you know, and it's, you kind of even think about like how you dance, like you even be moving a bit more of your hips, moving low. And, you know, in a state of euphoria, you're a bit kind of like raising your hands or like elevating your hand. I actually just thought of that. But like when I think about it, it kind of just comes
great
to me.
Yeah.
Just talking out of my ass.
We're going to do like a crash course in chakras. What are all the chakras? I'm genuinely asking this question.
Yeah. Okay. So there's the root, then the sacral, then the solar plexus, then the heart, which is in between the lower and the higher. And then the throat chakra, third eye, and then the crown. Did I miss one? Oh, I got them. Yeah, okay. That's my soundboard.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know. When I think about your sets, maybe it's like a healthy mixture of.
Yeah, I never thought about it until now.
Energy.
So thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Your career, I mean, it obviously has taken a real turn in the last couple of years, and you're making regular appearances at Pano. You're booked on stages on the major festival circuit. When and how did that happen exactly?
It's funny, to be honest. It was like, and I still feel, you know, it's still been this like slow burning, like upward rise. But I feel like there was a turning point in between, like I'd say like the lockdowns when things started opening up, particularly in Berlin. What was this? This was in 2020 when there was like 2020 to 2021, you know, in between we've had like, I feel like many stop and go like lockdown moments, but there was just a point when I feel like I started getting tapped to play like some of these open air spaces when we were allowed to party a bit. And again, I have no idea, but you know, I just started like hearing from my agent at the time that, you know, I was tapped to play at Panorama Bar for the opening night, which was, yeah, like when the clubs reopened in 2021. Yeah, from there on, I feel like that was where my relationship with them began, and they continued to book me, for instance.
Oh, that's great. Where do you hope to take things next? Like, do you have any specific goals?
Definitely. I'd love to continue fostering this relationship I've developed between like fashion and music, and finding ways to still, finding creative ways to bridge that for myself personally. You know, whether it's like continuing, like bringing in elements of curation, and as well as returning to my writing roots. I actually majored in English literature, creative writing in university. And I've just also felt this like, kind of like yeah, like this voice. Yeah, that's saying that I need to return to that, for instance.
Like write a novel.
Yeah, or? For instance.
Yeah.
Yeah, there's actually like a project I'm really excited about that I slowly began working on. And it was actually inspired by like a health scare that I had a few months ago. And tying it back into the music sphere, it just, you know, taught me I had to cancel about a month's worth of shows. And it taught me about like, yeah, just how vulnerable we are, you know, in this industry. True. Particularly like what I'd gone through, like the structural sexism in the medical community, and already kind of gathering research and speaking to, you know, other women in the industry, recognizing I'm not alone there. And yeah, just wanting to highlight that.
Yeah, I've read, just like tangentially, I've read quite a bit about how so many things in the world, I mean, they're designed for men, even just like seatbelts in the car. Yeah, so they're not actually very safe for people who aren't built that size. So it's it's interesting. I hope you pursue that product.
Yeah, thank you. Yes. Yeah, definitely. I'm already working on it.
Yeah. What else is inspiring to you right now? Musically, what are you listening to? Who are you digging?
Like for me, like I actually love having a nice balance of listening to just other genres of music as well outside of dance when I'm home. Mm-hmm. And I feel like it also just keeps when I do return to dance music really fresh. You know, so honestly, like jazz will always be like one of my favorite. Yeah, just passions. It's just like, you know, just like in my DNA.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And I've really been enjoying like having that balance of like easy listening things at home. Yeah. So that's been inspiring me.
Okay.
And it just recharges me to get back into it.
Nice. I mean, aside from the book, what else are you working on now? What's like on the immediate horizon for you?
Honestly, like really returning to radio, like a bit more, yeah, just spending more time on it because I did take a backseat for quite some time in the last year. Yeah, just due to touring and whatnot and just wanting to find ways to like attack it more like creatively. I think for me, when I've been doing radio, I wasn't speaking so much just out of my own shyness, for instance. And for instance, like this interview is already helping me get over that. And yeah, just wanting to be a bit more, I guess, yeah, expressive in that form.
Okay, nice. Yeah. So how often are your shows on Refuge?
Yeah.
Or how often will they
be? Yeah. I mean, they were monthly or bi-monthly, depending on my schedule. But yeah, I am hoping like in the autumn to, yeah, just have it a bit more frequent for sure.
Okay, nice. Well, I'm looking forward to that. Well, it was great speaking with you.
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Everyone, go see her play tomorrow, the festival.
Thanks for coming.
Thanks for listening to this episode of The Aria Exchange with Gabrielle Quartang. The song playing in the outro is Human Movement by Elevate, which she played in her Boiler Room set 2 years ago. If you liked what you heard in this episode, please subscribe to The Aria Exchange wherever you listen to podcasts and check out our full archive of conversations on aria.co or on Spotify, SoundCloud, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you regularly tune in. This episode was filmed and you can find snippets on our Instagram and YouTube channels. Thanks so much for joining me. I'll see you next week.